This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley.
And I'm Rachel Phillips. Coming up on today's show...
More individual species have gone extinct in Alabama than any other state in the nation. We find out why.
Scientists are controlling rabies in wild animals in the Northeast.
It can be a deadly disease, but it's part of a natural system.
Listeners comment about energy taxes and alternative fuels.
A conversation with Pat Shea. He's the new director of the Federal Bureau of Land Management and custodian of 270 million acres of federal land.
He says some property rights activists are playing the politics of fear for their own ends.
And on the Earth calendar, we're blown away by the hurricane season.
So stay with us for these stories and more coming up on The Environment Show.
Alabama's Mobile River Basin is a rich, lush example of the biodiversity of the southeastern United States. It's a fertile landscape with thousands of plant and animal species. But in recent years, scientists have discovered that the basin is also the site of the largest mass extinction in the North American continent since the Pleistocene age. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
Alabama, a state that is typical of America's natural landscapes, with diverse aquatic ecosystems. It is home to large turtle populations, third in the nation in fish species with 160, and one of the top 10 sites in the world for river mussels. However, Alabama also has the distinction of having far more animal extinctions than any other state in the continental U.S. Half of the extinctions that have occurred in North America since the Ice Age have been in the state of Alabama. The majority of these extinctions occurred in Alabama's Mobile River Basin, where some 38 snail species have died off, the result of damming some 1,000 river miles. The state's snail fauna is considered among many to be the most extensive in the world. Paul Hartfield is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. His specialty is endangered species. Hartfield says the practice of damming significantly changes aquatic ecosystems.
These were animals that were adapted to flowing waters. And as the dams were built, they impounded the river and basically slowed the currents. That allows sediments to settle on the bottom. But even without the sediments, these snails are adapted to flowing waters with high oxygen levels. They get their water, their food from flowing waters. So stopping the flow of the water was the primary reason for their decline.
Hartfield says it is important for people to understand that the extinctions were not on a local basis and that the animals are gone forever. He says a number of mussel and fish species have also become extinct as a result of the damming of Alabama's rivers. Hartfield says damming rivers fragments ecosystems that were once connected. George Folkerts, professor of zoology at Auburn University, agrees with Hartfield. He says the overall impact the practice of damming has on ecosystems in Alabama may never be fully understood. Folkerts also says the downstream effects of creating reservoirs can be catastrophic.
It may seem odd, but if you dam a river upstream, all of those effects are felt downstream as far as coastal areas of the ocean. The natural nutrient flows that come from the decay of substances in riverine bottomlands are one of the things that feeds the estuaries. So the rivers are linked to the sea. And, of course, the sea is linked to everything. And so if we begin messing up our rivers, it's just like messing up one part of your bloodstream.
Folkerts calls damming an old and poorly thought-out practice. Meanwhile, Paul Hartfield admits that damming has had negative effects on many species, but says the destruction was not intentional.
The rivers weren't impounded by a bunch of evil people out there, you know, trying to kill snails. The rivers were impounded to provide electricity and water and navigation and recreation. In other words, they were impounded to develop infrastructure. for the state of Alabama and adjoining states, state of Georgia, state of Mississippi. So, you know, this was, people didn't think about these things. They weren't considered, for the most part, when these rivers were developed.
Hartfield adds that companies, local and state governments, and Alabama residents as a whole need to take more responsibility for the protection of the state's natural resources. Professor Folkert says residents need to rethink their relationship to the environment and says the state of Alabama has been treated like a third world country, selling out to the promise of economic prosperity.
We've sacrificed an awful lot to allow industries which lack suitable environmental controls to be sited in our state. We're more or less addicted to the idea of jobs and profit, just like an addict is dictated to crack cocaine, for instance. And the first thing we have to do is realize that man's relationship with the land is not in the end an economic one, but is a biological one.
Both Folkerts and Hartfield say steps need to be taken now to preserve and protect Alabama's resources. Again, biologist Paul Hartfield.
What we're going to see if we don't work together is a second round of extinctions, but it'll be much, much quieter or more subdued than the first one, and that'll be the blinking out of these individual populations and the gradual disappearance of them. I think the only way we can prevent that is by making people aware that of what has happened and of what does remain, and that this is truly a unique part of the Northern Hemisphere in terms of biodiversity.
Hartfield says non-point source pollution is the biggest threat to these aquatic species. He says educating the public is the easiest and most effective way to prevent the polluting of Alabama's waterways. Hartfield says maintaining the quality of a natural resource is far easier than trying to fix the situation later. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Anybody who lives in the Northeast and has seen a raccoon in their garbage can or in their yard knows that coons carry a deadly disease, rabies. Scientists say they're making progress in their struggle to keep the coon strain of rabies under control, but a new adversary has surfaced which may be tougher. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips has this report.
Since the early 1990s, animal control officials, veterinarians, health department officials, and others in the Northeast have been on the front lines in the war against rabies. The raccoon strain, which originated in Florida in the 1940s, has been spreading rapidly up the northeastern coast over the last 10 years, taking many local health departments by surprise. In recent years, residents of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York were also surprised that rabid animals were being discovered in their areas, towns, cities, or counties. This left many to wonder how and why the disease was entering their region. Dr. Donald Lyon is director of the Diagnostic Laboratory at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. He says rabies is a very misunderstood disease. Lyon says that it moves from the animal's saliva to the nerves, then to the spinal column.
It moves from the nerve up into the spinal canal, up into the spinal cord, and there may be signs once it gets to the spinal cord. It may start to show an encephalitis then, or we should call it a meningitis. The encephalitis comes when it gets to the brain, and usually that's when we really begin to see signs. And it can mimic any sort of neurological disease. So it does have a great ability to be confusing to people.
Dr. Lyon says that rabies is very treatable if detected early. He says it's rarely fatal if contacted by humans and easily preventable through vaccinations given to domestic animals. But your pet cat or dog may not be the only animal getting vaccinated this fall. Dr. Lyon heads the program at Cornell University, which has been helping to control the spread of rabies by supplying raccoons with chicken or fish-flavored baits that, when eaten by the raccoon, vaccinate the animal. The baits are the size of a matchbox car dropped from low-flying aircraft.
We ourselves are working with the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources and using their distribution method they've used so well for Red Fox. And that's fixed-wing aircraft. They're using aircraft that they use in firefighting, and a twin-engine de Havilland.
Dr. Lyne says the program is currently vaccinating areas in northern New York and Maine in an effort to stop rabies from spreading into Canada. The program is showing signs of reducing the raccoon strain of rabies, but researchers at Cornell are trying to determine just how effective the program has been. That's not an easy job. According to Dr. Ward Stone, wildlife pathologist with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, he says monitoring the number of rabies cases is exceedingly important, yet often poorly done.
County health departments vary, and as to how much intensity they can put into monitoring what's happening with rabies. Some health departments are essentially maybe several nurses that are primarily involved with home care, geriatrics, and it's very difficult for such small departments to know what's going on in the county. And there's also a cost to going out and picking up potentially rabid animals, taking them somewhere to have them beheaded. There's a fee for that usually, and it can be $25 to $50.
Dr. Stone says localities are oftentimes not willing to spend the money needed to effectively monitor the number of rabies cases. Therefore, according to Stone, it's difficult to determine how widespread the disease may be in a particular area. Stone says it's possible that the residents of the Northeast will see increased numbers of skunk and fox rabies. However, he's more concerned with the possible spread of bat rabies. He says vaccinating bats will be a challenge because of their vast numbers.
There is research being done along those lines, but I think that it's going to be exceedingly difficult because you have a lot of species, and they have different kinds of lifestyles. They live in different places, and there's absolutely huge numbers of them. They're in people's barns, and in their attics, and they're in trees, and they're in caves.
Dr. Stone emphasizes that Americans should not be overly afraid of the disease. He says rabies is just another part of the natural world that people should recognize and understand.
Rabies is going to continue to be with us. I don't see it disappearing in 5 years or 10 years or even 20 years. It's going to be around. And even if you vaccinate an area and seemingly drive that strain of virus out and the raccoons come back without it, you always have the potential of reintroducing it again. As soon as you've got animals that don't have the immunity, and of course they're reproducing every year, high reproductive rate in most wildlife, you have the potential of bringing it in again.
Dr. Stone says other parts of North America have been battling the threat of rabies. For example, fox populations in Canada, wild dogs in Mexico, and coyotes in Texas. Stone says that while disease does pose a small threat to citizens and domestic animals, he says he's more concerned with the attitudes Americans have toward nature. He believes Americans are turning away from the natural world to the protection and comfort of malls and other artificial environments. Dr. Stone says this practice may prove far more dangerous than any rabies strain. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips. Our toll-free comment line is 1-888-49-GREEN. Here are some of the recent comments we've gotten.
Here's a caller who said he enjoyed a recent story on energy, but says that we left out important information about energy and taxes.
You did a good job on the energy show, but when you talk about energy and taxes, I think it would be a very smart idea when they mention energy and renewables that they shouldn't be giving out tax incentives, but would you just do any tax that's produced within their own local municipality out of renewable sources, or even coal if it's local, that tax, that energy is not taxed if it's manufactured within that township or state. Of course, if it's in the township, they get a bigger tax reduction, but they don't get taxed, they don't get subsidized. But any fuel that's brought into the state is taxed extremely high. So, in essence, you're giving incentives to make renewable fuels locally.
Our next listener also appreciated a story on alternative fuels and wonders if we would pursue the issue further.
Calling to thank you for covering the hydrogen as fuel story this morning over WMAL. Also, the various useful byproducts that can be derived from the use of hydrogen or processing it. And lastly, to ask if you would consider doing a more in-depth coverage of this important development in the near future. With thanks.
There's been a lot of interest in hydrogen fuels, and that's an issue we're going to keep coming back to, because indeed, hydrogen may well be the fuel of the future. Give us a call and let us know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. You can also reach us through our email address, green@wamc.org. Our webpage is www.enn.com/envshow. On the web, you can hear The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer and give us all kinds of ideas through our questionnaire. For the first time in 3.5 years, the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, has a confirmed director. Pat Shea is a natural resources lawyer from Salt Lake.
He's recently been confirmed by the U.S. Senate to manage the agency, which, as a part of the Department of the Interior, has conservation responsibility for 270 million acres of federal land, primarily located in 12 western states. Since mining, grazing, and logging take place on many of those lands, as well as a lot of recreation, constant conflicts about resource use wind up on his desk.
Also under Shea's supervision are 9,000 employees. While he's based in Washington, Shea was at the BLM office in his home state of Utah when he took some time out to speak about the challenges he faces.
When people ask me how I feel about the job, I say I'm terribly excited. But I, by way of analogy, believe it's like trying to take a sip of water from a fire hose.
You've had a number of issues brewing in your own state, particularly with respect to national monuments and so on. Where do you see some of those coming out?
Well, I am a great believer that the Secretary, the Vice President, and the President, in one fell swoop, using the 1905 Antiquities Act, memorialized a legacy that future generations will say, that's what the Clinton administration did. If you've not visited, or the listeners haven't visited to the Grand Staircase, I would urge them to do so. It is a remarkable example of Colorado Plateau, and I'm very excited about the prospects of turning it into a sustainable development. A lot of the people in southern Utah believe in jobs only coming from extractive mineral activity or livestock type of activity. And I think we have a chance with the Grand Staircase to put forward a model of economic development in the form of tourism that will both allow for economic stability in the community, but not further degrade the land and the water that's there.
Another issue that is a federal land steward you will be facing is the property rights folk, including some who claim that the federal government has no claims on federal lands, the county movement. Is that a threat that is going to cause you difficulty?
Now, obviously, in this country, under the First Amendment, everybody's entitled to their opinion, and they're free to express it. But as a lawyer, having taught constitutional law, I can tell you and your listeners with absolute certainty, the basis of asserting private ownership over these public lands is completely without merit. There is no historic merit, and there's certainly no legal merit. And I think you've got a group of people who are promoting it for their own benefit, and who play the worst game of politics, and that's the politics of fear.
There will come a time when you will return to private life. What do you hope to be remembered for as a steward of the BLM?
Creating sufficient ecosystems that biodiversity will have been promoted, to have encouraged the education of the American public, but specifically our children, about the importance of maintaining a healthy environment, and to use the land wisely and to make sure that it's seen not just as use for this generation or the next generation, but talking 30 or 40 years down the track.
That was Pat Shea, our new director of the Bureau of Land Management in the United States Department of the Interior.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's the hurricane season.
This is the time of year when the Gulf and East Coasts get hit with the strong winds and rain that come with hurricanes and tropical storms.
Jerry Jarrell, acting director of the National Hurricane Center, says that September threatens to be a very active month, even though hurricane activity in the summer has been uneven.
Yeah, I think the best description of the hurricane season this year is lumpy. We had a very active July, which is unusual. You usually maybe have at most one storm in July. We had four. You usually have three or four storms in August. We had none. And now September looks like it's coming on a cropper.
I asked Gerald what forms hurricanes in the first place.
We don't know all there is to know about it, but what we know is that you need an existing low-pressure system. Air moves in toward the low-pressure system, as it always does, and as it moves in, ocean water evaporates into the air, taking with it the latent heat of vaporization. Now, at the low center, it's coming in from all directions, so it must rise. As the air rises, the water condenses, therefore that latent heat that it brought with it is released, and that causes the condensation causes rain. And, of course, it causes a column of air to heat up because it's of the release of latent heat. Now, that drops the pressure, so the next air comes in a little faster because the pressure is lower. So it starts a cycle, and this cycle continues, and as it continues, that air moves faster and faster until you have it moving at hurricane force, which is about 75 miles per hour.
Once the hurricane gets over land, it's cut off from its energy source, which is the sea, and it ultimately dissipates. Other natural forces also affect the formation and path of hurricanes.
One is El Niño. That's the periodic warming of the South Pacific, which causes west winds over the Atlantic that push hurricanes away from our coasts.
Is it fair to say that with the El Niño, which I gather is one of the earliest and strongest we've seen, we can anticipate less hurricane activity than normal, if there is such a thing as normal?
I think that's partially true. We can expect less than we would have had without El Niño, but there are other factors, and some of those other factors are suggesting that we're in for a period of more active hurricane seasons. The 40s and 50s had very active hurricane seasons up into the 60s. Then we started a period of about 25 years that has just ended recently, we think, where we had very inactive seasons. We didn't have the big disasters like we had in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Gerald thinks that now we're 2 or 3 years into another cycle of more hurricane activity. Typically, he says those cycles last about 20 years.
Given the fact that more hurricanes are on the way, Gerald was willing to share some particularly vital information with the Environment Show.
To ask you a really complicated scientific question, who names the hurricane?
That's probably the most frequently asked question we get here. There was a group of people that are representatives of the World Meteorological Organization, a part of the UN, that compiled these lists. They compiled six lists in 1978. And they have pretty much remained unchanged. They're alternating male and female, and they have flavors of the countries represented in the Caribbean, lots of English-speaking names, several European names, and several Latino names. So it's a nice mixture, and some of them are a little hard for us to say. And the only time that those get changed are when you have a very notorious storm, Andrew, Hugo, for example, Fran this last year. then those names are retired and we replace them with another name. So otherwise, every 6 years, you'll hear the same list of names repeated.
Peter was talking there with Jerry Jarrell of the National Hurricane Center. This is the Environment Show. I'm Rachel Phillips.
And I'm Peter Burley.
This is the Environment Show. I'm Rachel Phillips.
And I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a researcher challenges the conventional wisdom by suggesting that sustainable forestry may not work. He says in some cases, more of the forest can be saved by logging off all of a high-value species and preserving what's left.
We talk green about the laws that govern how our national forests are managed. U.S. Senator Larry Craig from Idaho thinks they should be rewritten, and environmentalists are very skeptical.
Musicians Tingstad and Rumble use their talents to promote the environment, but they shun the environmentalist label.
These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show.
An article of faith in the environmental community is that the only way to manage forest ecosystems, other than locking all the people out, is to practice sustainable forestry. Sustainable forestry means different things to different people, but the underlying idea is that trees are cut selectively and the remaining forest continues to grow. Done properly, this process should continue indefinitely because no more wood is harvested than nature can replace.
A group of researchers is challenging the conventional wisdom. They suggest an alternative might be to log the species of very high value all at once, and then protect what's left of the forest. With the valuable trees gone, they say it would be easier to save the remaining tree cover. They also suggest it's better to get the loggers in and out all at once, even if they do remove all of one species of tree, rather than having them continuously in the woods, cutting a little bit all the time.
Dick Rice is senior editor of Resource Economics at Conservation International, an environmental organization with headquarters in Washington, D.C. He's worked in the Amazonian jungle in Bolivia, and he's co-author of a recent article in Scientific American which questions the effectiveness of sustainable forestry.
In Bolivia, and in many areas of the Amazon, really, the only a few tree species out of, say, 90 or 100 are economic to remove from the forest. The transport costs are high and demand is low. So once those trees are taken out, very little of the forest has been disturbed, but a huge percentage of the value, the current value of the forest, has been removed. So after that, you could just offer them money to leave and then concentrate on protecting the forest rather than trying to mitigate the damage from continued logging forever.
If we think of the sea as an analogy, one is reminded that we've removed
high-value species, and when they're gone, then people go after something that was considered a trash fish before, but now becomes food. And then when that one's gone, they go after the next one. Isn't that something that would be repeated if your theory on taking the valuable trees out and leaving the rest was put into effect?
Certainly there's going to be continued demand for the timber. It's not like they're going to take the mahogany and then close shop and leave. My only point is that if we're trying to find a way to mix conservation and development, I think it's worth recognizing that once the mahogany had been taken out, 90 or in some cases 100% of the current value of the forest has been removed as well, and that presents an opportunity to mix conservation and development sequentially rather than at the same time.
What would your approach do to biodiversity if one was eliminating high-value species?
Well, let's make it clear to begin with that I'm not advocating the elimination of a high-valued species. This is only something that should be considered in areas that are going to be logged anyway. It's just a matter of how much biodiversity you lose. And I think that one thing that, well, a couple of things people need to recognize. One, in many areas, there's no way to get here from there or get there from here in terms of implementing sustainable management. There's not enough, there's no economic incentive for loggers to adopt it voluntarily. The government hasn't the capability or the political will to force loggers to adopt it. So we're really taking advantage of a situation that exists. But in terms of the impact on biodiversity, even if sustainable management were implemented, for example, even if loggers found it advantageous to invest in regenerating mahogany, and didn't do more damage to the forest in the process than they do without trying to regenerate mahogany. But in a commercial setting, you're not going to get the big old trees back that were there to begin with. And that's where much of the biodiversity habitat is. So it's not clear that even if you implemented sustainability for a species like mahogany, that it would have a positive impact on biodiversity. It might well have a negative impact on biodiversity.
In a further challenge to conventional thinking about forestry, Rice says that sustainable management of 300-year-old trees doesn't make any sense, since the trees are not going to regenerate and are not a renewable resource. When it comes to harvesting old-growth timber, he says it's more like mining. He also says that in some parts of the Amazon, people didn't get there until they came to cut the trees. So there's no particular interest to be served through a sustainable forestry regime that keeps the loggers in the woods forever.
You know, a lot of places we're talking about, you know, the middle of nowhere, in which the only reason people are out there is to cut the trees. And I think it might be better if people viewed it as it is, and that is a mining situation. I mean, try to get a coal miner to string out the exploitation of the deposit, you know, forever just to maintain employment. It's most economic to harvest or to mine as much as possible as quickly as possible. And that's the same situation in the case of mining old-growth timber in natural forests. The best economic solution for the people that are earning a living from it is to cut those trees as rapidly as possible. And in a biological sense, since in a commercial setting, even if you did invest in regenerating the species, it wouldn't bring back the old growth. We're talking about a non-renewable resource.
Rice admits that his proposal to preserve forests after high-value species have been removed will only work in places like the Bolivian Amazon, where there are only a few high-value trees, in this case mahogany, which grow on each acre. In British Columbia, Canada, and in parts of the American Northwest, every tree is of commercial value. And so commercial logging without strict controls often leaves moonscapes behind. Rice and his colleagues have been accused of being naive and unrealistic, for thinking that once a high-value species has been removed, the remaining forest can be protected. But their challenge to conventional wisdom about sustainable forestry has stimulated a lot of thought about whether there is a difference between the forest and the trees. We're talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about forestry and proposals that U.S. Senator Larry Craig is making to change our forest laws and the way we manage our national forest. Senator Craig is a Republican from Idaho. If you have views about how we should manage our national forests, give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two guests with me today. One is Mark Ray, and he is a staff member of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and he speaks for Senator Craig. My other guest is Steve Hollander. He is the campaign coordinator of the Western Ancient Forest Campaign. That's a nonprofit group dedicated to protecting our ancient forests. And my guess is that these gentlemen have quite different views about forestry and how we should deal with our forests. So, let's begin with you, Mark Ray. Senator Craig is going to be making some proposals and submitting some legislation to change the way we manage our forests. What does he see is wrong with the way we manage our forests, and what needs to be done?
The bill that he'll be introducing this fall is a rewrite, a very extensive rewrite, of a piece of draft legislation that he began circulating for public comment, including groups like Steve's, last December. That draft was in turn the product of over 15 hearings that we held in the last Congress, reviewing basically all aspects of federal forest management. The one overwhelming conclusion that we came to at the end of those hearings, and that underlies the bill that we circulated last December, was that no witness in over 15 hearings and 200 pieces of testimony was happy with the way the status quo was operating. And that's really kind of profound when you think about it, because here in Washington, D.C., virtually every program, no matter how unpopular, typically has at least some supporters, some who will speak for the status quo.
Well, let's focus for a moment, and let's take that as a given, on some of the specific things that Senator Craig thinks needs to get done.
What we found was that we were taking, the federal land managing agencies were taking too long and spending too much to accomplish too little. The preponderance of his proposal is to try to simplify some of their planning and management processes and to arrive at decisions, whether those are decisions to cut more trees or to cut less trees, to do things or not to do things, to arrive at those decisions more quickly and with less taxpayer expense involved. So that's the essence of the proposal. It goes to the agency's planning processes, to how they budget, to how they deal with some of their administrative functions on the ground.
Okay. Well, Steve Hollander, this sounds like procedure, making things work better and so on. My understanding, though, is that you've got some real concerns about this.
Well, we do. I mean, it sounds innocuous enough, but I would agree with Mark that there's not a lot of support for the status quo. But you know, basically, what Senator Craig's solution has in mind would in fact be some of our worst concerns. Primarily, our organization represents a large, broad coalition of environmental groups, and we feel that our national forests should represent a broad range of values, things like clean water, fishing and wildlife opportunities, recreational opportunities. And we feel that Senator Craig's bill would shift the balance too far in the other direction and, in fact, make it much more difficult for concerned citizens to protect those other values that are represented by our national forests and would, in fact, make timber the predominant use of these forest areas. And given the tremendous amount of damage we've already seen caused to our forest by excessive road building and excessive logging, we think that that's an inappropriate course to take at this time. And, in fact, we support protecting key components of our forest ecosystems like the old growth, the roadless areas, and the riparian zones along our streams.
Mark, what about Steve's comment? Would indeed Senator Craig's proposal make it easier to cut more trees?
No.
I know that one of the things that the
private environmental advocacy groups have felt very strongly about is that they want to protect the right to go to court to challenge decisions made by the Forest Service to permit cuts in various places and so on. Am I right that Senator Craig's bill would limit that kind of procedural avenue that's been opened so far?
No. What the bill does is to preserve citizens' rights to go to court and, for the first time in statute, provide a right of administrative appeal of Forest Service decisions.
So, Steve Holmer, are you satisfied with what's being proposed here?
Well, having not seen any of the language here, all I have to go on is the previous draft of Senator Craig's bill, and there were several legal analyses done of that 100-page draft, and it was concluded both by the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund that, in fact, the bill would weaken a citizen's right to both participate in the process and also effectively represent other values that are not currently being fairly represented, such as clean water for our communities.
So let me ask you both something, and let's start with you, Mark. If one recognizes, and I think everybody does, that the forests have numbers of uses, how is the balance to be structured in a way that sees that not only timber production, but wildlife and recreation and clean water and so on are adequately thought about when decisions are made to sell off trees in the national forest?
Well, I think that balance has to be reflected in well-written statutes that give the agency some clear guidance as to what a proper balance among those uses is. The problem we have right now is the statutes are not very well-written in that regard. The only guidance that the agency has had has been from the courts, which has been ad hoc and in many cases after the fact. So one of the things we're trying to do...
Well, I have to fundamentally disagree with that. I think the real problem here is the Forest Service has, one, failed to comply with the law, and two, Congress has failed to adequately implement the forest plans. The only part of the forest plans that get full funding is the timber program.
Well, that's not
true. And everything else is not getting adequately funded.
No, that's just simply factually incorrect.
Let me ask you something about something fairly specific. There was a lot of criticism on the part of the environmental community when President Clinton signed the so-called timber rider, which permitted greater cutting in areas that presumably had been subject to various kinds of damage. And the charges made were that that was an excuse to allow a lot of cutting that otherwise would have been prohibited under the Endangered Species Act and a bunch of other things. Does Senator Craig's bill address that issue?
No, this bill doesn't address salvage timber harvesting to any particular degree. That piece of legislation dealt primarily with the health of the forest. This piece of legislation deals with the health of the Forest Service. But like that was the case with that piece of legislation, this one is subject to a lot of ad hominem attacks and mischaracterizations.
Well, yeah, one concern that we saw in the draft
that
was very similar to the logging rider was the idea of self-consultation by the U.S. Forest Service, where the Forest Service would be allowed to determine if their proposed project was in fact going to cause problems for endangered species. Under the current system, other agencies who do not have a vested economic interest in more timber sales would make a review of these plans, and in many cases they tell the Forest Service that what they're proposing is outside of the law. Under Senator Craig's bill, the Forest Service would be self-policing, and this was authority they were granted under the salvage logging rider, and we saw them consistently abuse this discretion that was granted to them, and frankly, they cannot
be
trusted.
Steve, your memory.
They have a direct economic incentive to cut more timber because they get to keep so much of the receipts for their own budget.
All right, well, let's resolve
they don't keep the receipts.
Hold on, let's resolve the issue of fact first.
Yeah. Did not contain a provision.
Let me ask you about the proposed Craig legislation. Would that provide for self-consultation on the Forest Service?
The December draft that we circulated did contain a provision which said that we would make the Endangered Species Act directly enforceable against the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, and we would require the biologists from those two agencies to comply with their Section 7 responsibilities on their own.
What is the point?
The point is you don't need two sets of biologists performing the same function. If you can hold one set accountable, and that's what the bill would do, Section 7 would still be complied with, then you have freed up the work of that second set of biologists, Fish and Wildlife Service.
But Steve Holmer makes the point that the guys in the Forest Service, to some extent, are dependent on revenues that the forests produce.
That's preposterous.
No, that's not, absolutely not. They fight the money from both the salvage fund and the KV fund to pay for salary and overhead. As much as 30 to 60% of all the timber receipts in those accounts is not used for their intended purpose. They're used for overhead
and
to pay these salaries.
And there is a problem with an excess overhead draw on the part of the Forest Service.
They're currently under three lawsuits about this very issue,
which
Congress never gave them the authority to take those funds.
All right, well, let me ask you both something.
That's a separate issue.
Let me stop you both and ask you something. If indeed, and it may be excess, but if indeed there is a heavy draw from these receipts that are gotten from the sale of timber, doesn't that raise a fair question as to whether the Forest Service can appropriately determine whether something that might cut their revenue is necessarily in the best interests of the forest as a whole?
I think the fairer question that it raises is why aren't we appropriating adequate funds for the Forest Service to cover its overhead functions?
Or
are those overhead functions too high?
Steve, let me ask you something.
Mm-hmm.
There is a presumption, I think, on the part of many of the forest advocacy groups that the Forest Service tends to come down on the side of industry in more cases than not.
Mm-hmm.
If that is indeed the presumption, and one of the things that we want to secure is confidence in our governmental agencies on the part of everybody, what would you do to correct that situation?
Well, I think Chief Dombeck of the Forest Service identified one area in a statement earlier this year in February. He emphatically stated that the best thing the agency could do to restore public trust was avoid controversial areas like the old growth and the roadless areas and our key watersheds that produce water supplies. And so, you know, we think that that is a nice outline. Unfortunately, we see a large number of sales that actually would go in and log and build roads in these areas. We also see continued subsidies for the timber sale program as a whole. Right now, the sale program is losing several hundred million dollars a year, and there is a reform effort underway. Senator Bryan from Nevada will be offering an amendment on the Interior Appropriations Bill this week to cut subsidies for road building on the national forest system.
Mark, the proposal that the Forest Service could do better simply by staying away from some of these areas that are in controversy, is that good policy or not?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that trying to evade or avoid controversy is a poor mechanism for bringing some resolution to these issues. These issues call out for resolution, for closure, for finality, for a willingness of people to get in, ventilate the facts on all sides, and make a decision. Conflict avoidance is not going to increase anybody's confidence in any agency of government. And, you know, to the extent that the environmental community views the Forest Service as not particularly favorable to their point of view, you can find forest industry people who feel exactly the same way. That's just the nature of the battle here in these areas of intense controversy.
Yeah, I think ending controversy isn't really our goal. Our goal is to protect the forest ecosystem, and there's an abundance of scientific data produced by independent parties and by the government that show these areas are worth a lot more to our society by protecting them than by roading and logging. The Forest Service has data that shows that recreation is, in fact, the biggest money-generating engine on our national forest system, and in our view, that's a much more sustainable economic paradigm than you are from intensive resource extraction.
Well, and they also have data that show that recreation users are the largest category of users of forest roads. But you have hit on one thing that we can unqualifiedly agree together on, and that is ending controversy is not your goal. Yeah.
We've been talking green in the Environment Show. My guests have been Mark Ray, and he's staff member of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and spoke today on behalf of Senator Larry Craig, Republican from Idaho. Also with us has been Steve Holmer, campaign coordinator of the Western Ancient Forest Campaign, a nonprofit advocacy group dedicated to protecting our ancient forest. I'm Peter Burley, your host. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN.
Musicians Eric Tingstad and Nancy Rumble have been combining their music with environmental causes for many years now. But Eric explained to me why they don't call themselves environmentalists.
We did at one time use the phrase quite a bit in our routine, but we've become a little more fond of the word preservationist. It's a little friendlier, and it sort of encompasses not only, you know, the immediate natural environment, but also elements of the environment that man has used, you know, in architecture and in gardening and in design.
For Eric and Nancy, preservation is tightly linked to their music.
It's inspirational for us, inspirational on a couple levels, in that when you're out in the woods or near a lake or in an old fine building, sometimes the solitude and the solitariness of it is inspiring, but also just the proportions. I mean, you can look at it like the craftsmanship of the building, and you can be inspired by other person's, you know, efforts and admire those, and it sort of releases the muse in us in a way. But then, of course, when you're out in a garden, you can see the same thing, but then in nature, too, you just see the bigger plan, as it were.
I think, too, the fact that when you've toured in different parts of the country and you see a variety of the way that things have been done in terms of the architecture, or where maybe land has been clear-cut, different types of things have happened, you realize how special it is in the other areas where the preservation has taken place and how aesthetically beautiful it is and how it serves people in so many different ways.
Many of their concerts are given as benefits for various causes.
Often when we'll go to a community, we'll talk to them about what the issues are in their area that they feel are important. And sometimes it is a building they're trying to preserve. Sometimes it is a garden. Sometimes it's a cause that they're trying to save, a river, clean it up. You know, it just really depends on the location. Seed Savers is one of the organizations that we've done some work with. And what they've been actually doing is helping preserve heirloom seeds in terms of the diversity of seeds. Sometimes we keep cutting down and getting more and more hybrids, and it's very important to have a diversity, just like in people. You know, we don't want all one race of people. That diversity is critical. And at this point in time, there are not very many people who are focusing on that. And the Seed Savers, which is based in Decorah, not only has a seed bank of these types of seeds, but encourages people across the country to network with one another and send seeds to each other in the mail. And so it's a wonderful group.
Eric and Nancy have been recording and performing together for many years now and have several albums out on the Narada label. But they never lose sight of why they're doing it.
It's our culture. It's our heritage, and it's important to know where we've come from, you know, that to look back and perhaps learned lessons just in our immediate day-to-day living, but then there's also the bigger lessons that are brought in. And this, you know, it's a wonderful country that we live in. And although it's relatively short in history, there's so many things that that are inspiring and I think need to be remembered.
We've been listening to Bonsai Picnic out on their In the Garden album. Pastoral is their most recent album. Nancy Rumble and Eric Tingstad record for the Narada Lotus label.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley.
And I'm Rachel Phillips. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN. Ask for show number 402.
The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, the Oliver and Jenny Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE.
So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.